are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 8th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dar Jamal, journalist, author, his latest, The End of Ice, bearing witness and finding meaning in the path of climate disruption. Also on the program today, Kirsten Nelson quits the DHS to spend more time separating families. Meanwhile, Trump administration needs 2 years to reunite those separated kids with their parents. Trump administration designates the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. And Obama refuses to turn the page on his disastrous political posture of the past. And welcome our upcoming constitutional crisis, which will involve Trump's taxes. Meanwhile, Bernie calls for re-enfranchising felony prisoners. U.S. troops pull out of Libya as violence rises. The Israeli elections are tomorrow. And lastly, dozens of administration whistleblowers have been revealed to be working with the House Democratic Oversight Committee. That could be interesting. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for joining us this week. A little bit of house cleaning. We're managing a daycare center here too. We're trying to develop all sorts of revenue streams at the program at the moment. Speaking of revenue streams, I will be heading to Vegas this week to ostensibly cover the tort lawyer conference, but in actuality, parlaying some of your support of this program into an ability to get a brand new set of cameras, and I've got it down this time. I'm gonna make it work. But I will be in Vegas on Thursday and Friday, interviewing tort lawyers about various topics that are out there. I don't really usually know who I'm going to be interviewing until I get there. There are a couple of cases about trafficking, apparently, that some tort lawyers are working on. But I will I'll have a better sense of who I'm going to be interviewing when I get down there. So just a heads up on that. Meanwhile, is it Kirsten Nelson? I mean, this is probably the last time I'm ever going to say her name, Kirsten. I guess, or Kirsten.
Kirsten
Nelson. There's two things that, is it Nielsen? Yeah. Nielsen, sorry.
It's not important.
Yeah, I mean, the real reason why you should know her name is because she's a horrible human being. And we have seen her testimony multiple committees over the years. And there should be no reformation for people like this. This is it. Their careers have been locked in. She can find a job, obviously, in some corporate structure. But these people, they need to be held to account. There is no leaving the Trump administration and getting a clean pass. There is no, it was not my idea. I was literally just following orders. I mean, honestly. Seriously. Here she is, just to remember. She was bragging about how well they're taking care of the children back in June of 2018. We now know that in at least, I mean, I don't know how many instances make it appalling. I think one does. But in many instances, the so-called family separation, which, to be clear, is taking children from their parents. This is not, I'm separating two adults who can then pick up a phone and call or leave wherever they are and find each other. They're not separating families. They're taking children from their parents. And here she is bragging 2 years ago to, I guess, some sheriffs. This is the National Sheriffs Association saying, don't believe your... And again, this is before the stories of children dying in their custody, the stories of children being lost, children having no idea what was going on, all the stories of the way the children were reacting under intense stress because they've been kidnapped. Here she is bragging to the National Sheriff's Association that, relatively speaking, the way that we warehouse these children is pretty good.
It is important to note that these minors are very well taken care of. Don't believe the press. They are very well taken care of. You know this, as many of you have detention facilities of your own. We operate according to some of the highest standards in the country.
Pause it. Some of the highest standards in the country? And really, what are the standards that they're competing against? Other facilities that detain children, I guess? For-profit prisons?
Start kicking in.
Right. Go ahead.
We operate according to some of the highest standards in the country. We provide food, medical, education,
wow,
and all needs that the child requests.
Wow.
This literally does sound like a guy that they just nabbed after, like, having children tied up in his basement for years and just like, I always fed them.
That
does not sound, like, morally different to me at all. You're supposed to feed and give medical care to children you've
right.
kidnapped. That's the very least.
That's the baseline.
Yeah, what do you want to say? Like, other people, like Steve was proposing that we starve them.
You're also supposed to do that for animals in your care, for that matter. Here is Christian Nielsen's former press secretary, David LaPan, talking on NPR. I can't imagine there's been much that he got much pushback to his attempt to sort of to make it seem like, well, she had no choice. She was, deep down, she's a good person.
When she defended the policy that was so controversial leading to family separation, I mean, did you think that you were seeing someone who believed in that policy or who was representing her boss?
My view is that she was representing her boss. And in many ways, again, that's the role that the secretary plays. Remember, too, that what really started that that policy, or what led to that, was the zero tolerance policy put in place by the attorney general. So at the time, I thought that it should have been the attorney general that was there having to defend the policy and not the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Here's why that type of excuse is such BS. Because, A, we know that she could have resigned. Like, if you had any type of moral compass and the attorney general says, we're going to implement a policy that's going to require your agency to warehouse children in a record manner, and we're going to not only you're going to warehouse these children, they are going to be forcibly removed from their parents. You're then going to label them as unaccompanied minors because you have made them unaccompanied. You're then going to shuttle them to the furthest reaches of this country in the middle of the night at times, so that human beings who do have a moral compass can't see what you're doing. That's a very good opportunity to say, you know what? Pass. I think I'll resign. Like, it doesn't matter whether it was her idea or Donald Trump's. If you don't have, I mean, and we have seen this time and time again, right? Like, if she's not there, it's going to be someone worse. But apparently it's going to be someone worse anyways. And we've seen it time and time again. All the generals who were saving us from Donald Trump. Well, then why would you ever leave? Then why wouldn't you go public immediately the day after you're out? Right? I mean, if you're being held hostage there for the sake of the country, I can't quit, because if I quit, horrible things are going to happen. On day one, we should already be watching the multitude of interviews with Christian Nielsen on every network talking about the horrors she saw and her screaming to the heavens, like, I'm going to be the first witness at the impeachment trials. But we don't. So it's bullshit. It's bullshit.
Yeah. And what's with the quote unquote liberal media letting these ghouls come on to rehabilitate
NPR,
themselves?
The NPR has been the same as it always has been. It is a corporate mouthpiece to power. That's it. They have never been anything different. And that's why they go there. It's because they know they're not going to get challenged. Even less so. Well, if we go to Fox, of course we're not going to get challenged, but nobody's going to take us seriously. And if we go to any other network, frankly, we might get challenged. It's grotesque. She should be shunned in public. It's really disgusting to watch anybody who would in any way help with the reformation of these people.
What sector do you think she's going to lobby for?
My guess is, if I had to guess, she's going to be working for the private prison industry in some fashion or another, just because she's well-versed. And you know why she's going to be doing it? Because she wants to make it better for the children.
She doesn't lobby for it. Think of how bad it's going to be.
I am so proud of the initiative that I started at the private prison industry, when we now have organic milk for the kids.
Well,
juice boxes.
That's a stretch.
We paired.
Good for the milk people too.
Well, we paired with a major organic producer, and it's just wonderful. The kids you could just see the looks on their eyes.
I know of at
eyes.
Least three instances when a kid had a fever and we gave them medication for it.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe a diversity program for the prison guards.
We were able to have Coca-Cola sponsor many vending machines in the place. Now, of course, they don't have cash.
Oh, now Matt's all of a sudden like, huh.
Human rights.
Folks, reminder, you want to protect your loved ones with the peace of mind of life insurance. Think you can't afford it? Chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. SelectQuote comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, Mutual of Omaha, and others, to find you the company with best rates. For example, SelectQuote could find you a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. It's less than a dollar a day. A cup of coffee costs more than that. SelectQuote's breakthrough technology allows them to quickly match you with the best insurance company to find your best policy. Plus, quotes are free. I've told you guys many times before, for each of my children that were born, I ended up getting life insurance, but I'm old. I was old when my kids were born, and I'm older now. Get it while you're young. If you're anticipating the birth of a child, or if you have any reason to believe your loved ones might need help if you die, that's what insurance is for. And it is, believe me, it's quite a relief. And to have an easier way of finding the best rates makes a big difference. SelectQuote could save you time and money. You can get your free quote at selectquote.com/majority today. That's selectquote.com/majority for your free quote. Don't put off protecting your family another day. Selectquote.com/majority. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/majority. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states. Check it out, folks. Also, I feel like I don't even have to pitch this to you, but the New Yorker represents the best writing in America today, both online and in print. New Yorker covers a full range of topics, including politics, news, international affairs, climate change, popular culture, the art, fiction, food, humor, cartoons, you name it. I don't know if a week goes by when we're not citing a New Yorker story. Not to mention New Yorker touches on subjects that many readers may not have previously put much thought into, like the world's diminishing supply of sand or paper jams, stink bugs. I've actually thought quite a bit about stink bugs.
I believe that.
Hunting down heirloom beans. Yeah, that was the bug that was on Hannity. New Yorker's incredible writers include contributors like Ronan Farrow, who's written Breaking News and Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, some of the biggest stories of the year, and Helen Rosner, a James Beard award-winning food writer who contributes essays and reports on all things gastronomic. Am I saying that right? There's all sorts of stuff that you can check out in the New Yorker. I have been reading this story about a guy who I didn't really know, but the rise and fall of a New York shock jock. How Trump betrayed the general who defeated ISIS by Robin Wright. These are just some of the stories that's in there. There's five scenarios for the Israeli election. William Barr's Choices by Jeffrey Toobin. Joe Biden and the Perils of Good Intentions. We'll see about that. But all these stories, hugely relevant. And of course, I tend to focus on the political ones. But now our listeners can save 50% and get 12 weeks of The New Yorker for just $6. When you go to newyorker.com/majority, enter majority. You'll also get an exclusive tote, as well as unlimited access to the New Yorker's apps, online archives, crossword puzzle, newyorker.com, with 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. That's newyorker.com/majority. Enter the word majority. Check it out. It's sort of obscene. 12 weeks for $6, and you get the tote. You give the tote away as a birthday gift to somebody. I think that's what I'm going to do. Meanwhile, this episode of the Majority Report is being supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. We've talked about the various reasons why you might want to start meditating. It has over 2,000 guided meditations. They're designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with. So you could use Simple Habit to deal with mindfulness or meditations for anxiety or for depression or when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination or when you just have something important going on at work. Meditations are designed designed for parents. They have meditations that are specifically for different times during the day, like when you're waking up or your lunch break or when you've just gotten home from work or when you're going to bed. Different people meditate at different times in the day. And this is the best thing about Simple Habit from my perspective, is that you literally have so many different types of meditations and so many that are tailored for the specific context in which you're dealing with. People try different things with meditation. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what your goals are, regardless of what kind of past experience you've had with meditation. It's the variety of these meditations that sets Simple Habit apart. They just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available on iOS, Android, and web browser. And Majority Report audience can try it for free for an entire week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, We've put a link below the video description. If you're listening, we've put a link in our audio podcast description. All that. Check it out. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. When we return, Dar Jamal. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Dar Jamal. He is a journalist and author of multiple books. His latest is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Dar, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be with you.
Before you hopped on, I mentioned to you that I thought I think probably the last time we talked was when I was doing some iteration of this show on Air America, and you were in Iraq. Maybe you were out of Iraq at that time. I don't recall, but you were one of the few journalists who had not who were covering the Iraq invasion who had not embedded with troops. And I mean, how do you go from that type of coverage to climate, as you call it, climate disruption? We'll get to why you call it that way, but.
Well, I had, before I started working over in Iraq as a journalist, I was living up in Alaska and spending a lot of time in the mountains. And so I moved up there in 1996 and immediately saw really dramatic impacts of runaway climate disruption, even then, with dramatically receding glaciers and having it raining in Anchorage during Christmas time and things like this that were just huge anomalies and very much out of the norm. So the seed was planted back then. And then when I, several years later, where I started working as a journalist, but started doing that
in Iraq, all the while in the back of my mind was what was happening. And then, of course, by then, more and more studies coming out, more and more alarming observations about what was happening with climate disruption. So the stage was really set. And then at the end of my war reporting, of course, I was completely burnt out on that and needed a break. And so that's when I decided to make the transition.
So let's go into the places that you visited, because in some respect, I mean, there's a similar dynamic here. I mean, obviously you back up personal assessments with data and with interviews with experts, but you're providing sort of on the ground, as it were, sense of what's happening. Let's start with Alaska then. You write about Denali. Tell us about your observations there, and what are the implications of those?
Well, I really bookend this book with my time on Denali, because that's really where my observations started. And so I made it a point to go back to places like Denali that I had a long-term relationship with. The first time I was on that mountain was in 1997. And in the book, I went back. It was 19 years later. It was 2016. I went back up there as a volunteer with a National Park Service team doing rescues. And so what I found was the Kahiltna Glacier, the main glacier that you traverse when you're going up the standard route on the mountain, had really lost a dramatic amount of ice. It over several decades, actually, it's lost at least 30 feet of thickness, enormous volume of ice. The toe was receding dramatically. And then even higher up on Denali, a mountain that's only about 250 miles south of the Arctic Circle, and is the summit's just over 20,000 feet. Even that high, there's dramatic loss of ice and changing of glaciers and things like rockfall that you have to worry about high up at 18,000 feet on the mountain, an area that previously we all had just assumed this is a permanently frozen area, and yet there's areas you have to wear a rock climbing helmet to protect yourself in case of rockfall. So really dramatic anecdotal evidence all over the place up there.
The rockfall being, I mean, I think that as the ice begins to melt, rocks become beget loose. I mean, that's the idea is that that was not an issue even a couple of decades ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Rocks that had been frozen into glaciers for millennia, or glaciers melting enough that rocks that were on the ground but being held there in place by ice that had existed for thousands of years was now loosening up.
And then talk about the implications of glaciers in this country, in the lower 48, I guess. I hadn't really given much thought to the fact that we have any, and I guess we may not for much longer.
That's right. This is where it gets even more dramatic. So I went out into Glacier National Park with Dr. Dan Fagry. He's a U.S. Geological Survey a scientist, and he said that in Glacier National Park, they are at the current trajectory of melting and temperature increases, they are on track to have no functional glaciers there by 2030. So that's a little bit less than 11 years from now. And then he said something that I also cited in numerous other studies, peer-reviewed studies, showing that at current trajectories of warming and melting, that we could have no glaciers left anywhere in the contiguous 48 states by 2100. So out here where I live in Washington State, where we have over 100 glaciers in Olympic National Park alone, hundreds of glaciers in the Cascades, these are very, very important for our water sources for drinking and agriculture and the ecological services that they provide to other species. To think about these all being gone in barely 80 years from now is quite shocking.
All right. Will you just walk us through that, though? The practical implications, because I don't think that people really spend much time contemplating what function glaciers play and how they play those functions in various parts. Not just here, but in the Himalayas or wherever, like what function glaciers serve, so that we get a sense of how this is going to impact people once they're gone.
Right. You mentioned actually a place that I think I could use as the best example to really underscore the point of the dramatic human impact. So the Hindu Kush region of the Himalaya, this is a giant, giant ice field with multiple glaciers, and it's the source of seven of Asia's major river systems. And that area is on a pace of melting, according to recent studies, that all that ice could be completely gone by 2100. Well, that ice serves those rivers, which serve 1.5 billion people, their drinking water and irrigation water. So if all that ice and water go away, where do all those people go? Because you cannot live somewhere where there's no water to drink nor any water for your crops. So that's a stunning thing to think about. So where do those 1.5 billion people go? And then what happens to the places where they go? Is there enough water there? Is there going to be enough food and housing, et cetera? So very, very dramatic human impacts. And even out here, we've already seen them when in 2015, the Olympic Mountains nearby where I live had 6% of their normal snowpack. Glaciers are dramatically receding on top of that. So we had a statewide drought declared by May of that year. So we had water rationing in the small town where I live. Farmers on nearby organic farms were really struggling to make it to meet their water needs for their crops, and crops were being lost. So then we have food spikes and things that go along with that. Another dramatic example, just very briefly, I'll point out, is the Arab Spring. Many studies have shown that drought across the Middle East really set the table for these dramatically spiking food prices and the unrest and destabilization politically that it caused in those countries. And many people believe that was the spark that lit the fuse that caused the Arab Spring.
I don't want to get too hung up on the glaciers, but just, I mean, explain. I just don't think that people are conscious of like how it is that a glacier provides that kind of drinking water. In the case of the Himalayas, it's because the glacier continually is growing and shrinking in its normal state, but right now we just have it just shrinking, in which case this sort of reserve of water is just going to go away.
Exactly. So glaciers are always growing and shrinking, as you said. They're consistently getting fresh snow every year that compacts down and adds mass to the glacier. But at the same time, it moves, and in its lower regions and in its terminus, it does melt out, and then that provides river water and groundwater for everything below it, for growing trees, for animals, and for humans. But when you increase the atmospheric temperatures, there's less snow falls on the glacier, because a lot of the time the winter precipitation comes down as rain instead of snow. So that's a contributing factor to the diminishment of glaciers. And then, of course, as you increase the temperatures, there's going to be more melting. So it starts literally losing mass over time. And this is what I outlined in the book. I went out with a USGS team up on a major glacier up in Alaska that they've been studying for over 50 years and tracking a very, very consistent trajectory of mass loss across that glacier. And in their entire benchmark study program that covers glaciers that are representative in regions where they exist around the entire United States. And so they're all on a downward trajectory, and this is in line with what scientists are seeing globally, that all glaciers around the world are on a downward trajectory, and it's accelerating. And it's very disturbing because they also refer to glaciers as essentially the canary in the coal mine with climate disruption, because they're well along a pace of exhibiting the impacts that we've caused to the planet, and they're sort of an early warning indicator. And because of that, that's why this is so disconcerting.
I mean, in some respects, that's basically what you did. You visited different canaries, as it were, around the world, it feels like. One of those canaries was in Miami, and you met with, or I guess you went around with one of the city engineers, who was, and also I met with the chief geologist at the University of Miami. Tell us, I mean, I mean, I think people understand that Miami is built on essentially what is a sponge, and there is flooding is not sort of an event as much as it is a state of being now, it feels like, with Miami. But tell us what you learned there.
That's right. So I went around in Miami Beach, actually, with the city engineer at the time, Bruce Mallory, and they were actively raising the levels of many of the streets 3 feet to try to buy themselves time to prepare to mitigate for rising seas. And he knew that that probably wasn't enough. It was a temporary measure, but it was better than nothing. But it was already causing problems because flooding is a part of daily life there. Every time there's a high tide, and then if you throw in some significant rainfall and even a flooding event, then you're going to have big problems. And that's what they were already seeing in Miami Beach, where they were raising in one area, they'd raise the street 3 feet. But then, of course, you can't raise the houses and the buildings nearby. One of these high rise buildings flooded, and then the building owner was unable to get insurance because the insurance company then said, well, sorry, we don't have to pay you because your ground floor is now a basement. So there's unforeseen consequences like that that are already happening. And then over in South Miami, I interviewed Mayor Philip Stoddard, and he talked about how they're already having major problems with, as seas rise, it's coming up underneath the ground in the water table and causing major problems in people's septic systems, where literally every time it floods or there's a king tide, then people are literally having raw sewage coming up into their bathtubs and back up into their toilets. So you can't live in a place where that's happening. So you've got a situation where, as Dr. Harold Wanlis, the expert that you mentioned, who I interviewed at University of Miami, Coral Gables, a leading sea level rise expert internationally, and he said, just to cut to the chase, that we are locked in for dramatic sea level rises that most people have no idea are coming. He picked apart reasons why the predictions made by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are far, far, far too low. And he said, look, last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, seas were tens of meters higher than today. And to be specific, he said, look, last time we came out of a ice age, the atmosphere had 100 parts per million CO2 higher content after that happened. And what corresponded with that was 100 feet of sea level rise. So if we do the math, and I asked him this question, since we've had 130 ppm CO2 to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution began, I asked him, Dr. Wanlis, does that mean then we have 130 feet of sea level rise already baked into the system? And he said yes.
What does that mean? I mean, so people could theoretically right now go and see where they, you know, I imagine there's some site online where they could find out just about how high above sea level they are. And if they're at 110, they should find a little bit of higher ground.
Well, this obviously is going to take time for that much ice to melt. Right. The thing is, if you look around, it's in motion. There's no question about it. Dr. Eric Rigno, lead scientist of a major study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, came out just this January, the study that showed that melting across all of the Antarctic has increased sixfold since just the 1970s. He told the New York Times, quote, "Antarctica is melting away," end quote. So it's already happening. Obviously, that's going to take a long time. But there are some dramatic accelerations that we're seeing right now. The Thwaites Glacier there is melting away dramatically. The Western Antarctic Ice Sheet is melting away dramatically. And we're also seeing dramatic acceleration across much of Greenland. So we are seeing this acceleration start. This is over a time scale where maybe we'll see 10 feet by 2100, although Dr. Wanlis pointed to another study that said we could theoretically even see 10 feet by just 2050. So we are talking on a geologic time scale. That's a blink of an eye. But long term, what this means is that every major coastal city on the planet is going to be underwater. It's not if, it's when.
Right. We're talking right now for young people, their grandkids. This is going to be their grandkids, maybe their great grandkids are going to be rebuilt. Well, in some instances, Miami, it feels like, you know, grandkids, right? At least are going to be rebuilding or just closing down shop there, I guess.
Well, that's right, and that's what Dr. Wanless pointed out also, as did Mayor Stoddard, as did some of the other people in South Florida that I spoke with when I was doing my research, that if we had a government on a state and federal level that was behaving responsibly and really reacting the way that they should, given the crisis that's upon us and what's coming and what's already baked into the system, that they would be orchestrating, funding, and managing an orderly evacuation and relocation of essentially all of South Florida. All those people are going to have to go someplace else. They're going to have to get set up in new homes. All the toxic sites down there have to be remediated. Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant just south of Miami at 6 feet elevation has to be decommissioned and shut down, and all of that moved to higher ground. So you're talking about relocation of millions of people and all the businesses that are there. And instead, we see this just kicking the can down the road. So many of the politicians not even talking about this, pretending it's not happening, and certainly pretending that that humans aren't the cause of it. And he felt so strongly about this that he called that all the politicians that are behaving that way. He said, "Look, this is criminal negligence."
Isn't part of the problem on some level that we have people who are. That's just the span in which of time in which this is going to happen, a couple of generations, three generations. We don't have people in power who are going to be living that long. It just feels like it's easy to escape culpability. We're down now to the point where I think politicians feel and frankly, business leaders feel that they can escape culpability if there's, you know, we're talking about a timeline of 5 to 10 years, never mind one that is several decades to, you know, a century or so.
You know, that's a good point. And I suppose that's one of the factors that they just think that, you know, well, this isn't, I'm not going to have to deal with this. But, you know, counter to that is look at what's happening every summer now with these increasing frequency and strength of hurricanes and the flooding that comes along with them. And look at the damages just to the U.S. infrastructure on an annual level are going up just about every year now. And if you look at a long-term trajectory, that's unarguable. The flooding that comes along that, look at the wildfires, especially across the western U.S. and particularly California. Up here, the entire West Coast, the better part of the summer now, we have smoke that we're living in. I mean, it's right in our face all the time. And then the winter, of course, we have these polar vortexes as the Arctic continues to get further destabilized. So these dramatic impacts are right in front of our face already. And it's pretty amazing to me that these politicians are able to stay in and kind of perpetuate this crisis while kicking the can down the road while these impacts are already upon us.
You also traveled to the Great Barrier Reef. What did you find there?
Well, what I found there was extremely heartbreaking. I had been there for the first time back in 1995, if I remember correctly, and I was back there in 2017. The first week of what ended up being a major coral bleaching event. It was the second major event of that kind in as many years. And so coral bleaching is what happens when the water temperatures warm up so much that it's at a temperature that the corals can't survive in. So the beautiful algae on them that gives them their brilliant colors, that's a food source for them. And as the waters warm too much, that becomes toxic. The coral then ejects the algae so as not to die. But then it's starving to death, and it's bleach white, and that's why it's called coral bleaching. And if the waters don't cool back down in time, then the coral will die within three to six weeks of that happening. And that's what's happening. And so when I was there, the bleaching event was occurring, and huge swaths of the Great Barrier Reef were bleaching out. And between the event that happened in 2016, and then the one in 2017, And then another one happened in 2018. Over 50% of the reef that bleached out had died in just those 3 years alone. And then right now we have, you know, record warm temperatures in Australia again. And this is, you know, this is the single largest coral structure on the planet. It's 1,400 miles long. It's a World Heritage Site. And most scientists there and many of the studies say that the Great Barrier Reef is essentially in terminal stage and it probably will not be around for another 10 years.
Wow. So as you're traveling through let's talk about Stan Rushworth, because at the end of the day, as it were, you, in many respects, you argue that we're almost there, like that so much of this is already baked into the cake that really we need to figure out a way in which to mitigate this. Or are we at, like, you know, now the plan should be, how are we going to adapt? At what stage are we in this?
I do believe that's where we are. And, you know, working on this book and seeing all this firsthand and doing the research, I was confronted with dealing with my grief around this and all the feelings with that on a regular basis. And so I ended up meeting a Native American elder named Stan Rushworth. He's Cherokee. And we started talking, and he started sharing a lot of stories that helped a whole lot. So one of those is that in Western colonialist mindset, we have rights. What are my rights, right? But in indigenous cultures, they believe we're born onto the planet with two primary obligations. One is to serve and take care of the planet. The second is to serve and take care of future generations. And so no matter how bleak things appear to be, they do appear bleak. Humans could even go extinct. There's been a lot of writing about this. We are in the sixth mass extinction. But we don't know for sure that that's going to happen. We do know that tremendous change is baked into the system, and there's going to be a lot of suffering that comes along with that. But no matter how bleak things appear, if I get up each day and I'm thinking about, okay, how can I fulfill those two obligations to the best of my ability, to the planet and to future generations, then I've got my work cut out for me, and I've got no shortage of work to do. And I feel very, very strongly about doing that, especially when you look out and you see these student marches, you see these kids walking out of class. They get it. And so am I not going to live my life to serve those kids and be in the deepest solidarity with them as possible and still do everything I can to try to take care of the parts of this planet that are still intact, and these young kids that, you know, they're born into a world that they didn't create. They're going to have to live in it. So what can we do to help them?
I mean, as you look at this stuff, do you think that was there a period of time where we could have made, on some level, I wonder if human limitations, just from, the inability to see that far into the future and understand our actions today implicate the future, made it ever possible for us to do what needed to be done?
Well, it was back in the 80s when NASA scientist James Hansen went before Congress and sounded the alarm bell. He really, at that point, blew the whistle and said, look, we are changing the climate of the planet. If we don't make some dramatic shifts right now in how we are living and certainly the economy, we are setting ourselves up for some big trouble in the not-so-distant future. And if we had listened to him then, and if the U.S. had taken the lead as a leading economic country and said, look, we have to change this entire paradigm, globalized capitalism is literally killing the planet, And if we started making the dramatic changes back then, we possibly could have averted this. But instead, since then, everything has only accelerated at warp speed. Capitalism has become fully globalized and continues to be so. And, you know, if we're going to talk seriously about mitigation, the first thing we have to talk about is an entirely new economic paradigm, i.e. not capitalism, because this rampant industrial scale production of goods and consumerism, that is precisely what's killing the planet.
And we should also say that the structure of capitalism also created a lot of people who were doing their best to make sure that we didn't listen to people like James Hansen, right? I mean,
that's right.
I mean,
The system is set up to perpetuate itself, and we have this fossil fuel funded denialist meme in the country, and that's exactly born of the system. I mean, there's over a 97% consensus about human caused climate disruption, and it's 2.9% that either are doubtful about it or disbelieve it. It's you know, there's been some excellent journalism out, very, very easy to find for a long time, that shows that the vast majority of those doubters or deniers are fossil fuel funded.
Right. And so are you in any way heartened by something like the Green New Deal? I mean, it's still just a proposal, and is, you know, obviously getting a huge amount of pushback. And it's almost absurd that it's taken this long for just that idea to exist in some or at least in this more sort of tangible form as something that ultimately could be, a piece of legislation. But does that give you any encouragement?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it's anything is better than nothing at this point. And anything that could potentially mitigate this even a little bit is a worthy action. But my critique of it is it doesn't go nearly far enough, and it still doesn't call for a complete shift of the entire economic paradigm, because it's still essentially promoting economic growth and jobs, et cetera, when in reality I think we need to be looking squarely at the fact that the time for degrowth is upon us, and we can either start doing it willingly or it's going to be forced upon us. And I think that's really one of my major critiques of the Green Deal. But I don't want to be too disparaging, because that and other things, you know, anything moving in a better direction than where we're going now is important to do, no matter how fallible it is.
I think that's a good place of anywhere. Dar Jamel, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks.
Hoo boy.
Hard to have any kind of discussion about climate change and not have it be anything other than somewhat depressing. But
really? I feel great right now.
Yeah, I like the opportunity to live in a real-life sci-fi hellscape.
The argument that Jamel makes in the book is that they're just simply a moral imperative. So there is impetus to work towards attempting to mitigate the implications of climate change, regardless of whether it appears or to be having results or appears that it might have results.
There's a big thing missing from that interview, though.
Oh, man.
Pretty big dismissal of ideas.
Well, so
I just got to believe that if we have ideas, then we can innovate together. Then the innovation
competition would start kicking in.
That's why left-wing people hate ideas so much, because you're defeatists.
There's an article in Commune magazine would recommend, actually, called The Uses of Disaster. And it kind of goes with the premise that, like, we're probably not going to solve this problem before capitalist society begins to crumble. But maybe at least when that happens, it will create an opening to solve it then and also democratize the economy in the way that we need to do.
The point being, when there's 80% less people on the planet, and I'm not being facetious here, when there's 80% less people on the planet, you know, how are we going to live at that point? I mean, obviously we won't be here, but
yeah, it's probably going to suck.
Yeah, it's probably going to suck. But the point being that, you know, the it's going to be interesting to see how it's structured after the fall.
Certainly. And that's why I'm so interested in Posadism.
Name a single government.
There's going to be a lot of water.
It produced an overwhelming sense of impending doom.
Like, well, people want to make fun of it and say that it's crazy. Like,
I think that drop works, Matt.
Never have I felt right, like Jordan. I want to do more primary election coverage than right now.
Hey, but,
and maybe
Andrew
we
Yang's
need
dumb,
a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
We definitely
that was
need
what
that.
Was missing from that.
Have the climate scientists thought about that?
Yeah. Can we
get that to CERN or whoever, the IPCC? They should talk to...
Yeah, well, the IPCC is filled with a lot of negative thinkers.
Yeah.
A lot of people who don't have a sense of possibility.
Well, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half, which I say with more conviction than I've ever said before, will definitively be more fun than this half.
Run today to your fun space.
You can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, wherein you will support interviews like the one we just had. Jointhemajorityreport.com, and then we let you have access to the fun half so that we can at least go back to distracting you and making you feel better about things.
I don't know a lot better, but certainly distracting.
Yes. Slightly better about things as you go along your way and attempt, hopefully, to do your part and to mitigate this sort of freight train that is coming barreling down the tracks and heading towards
us. You get back to petty media conflicts.
Exactly. Exactly.
On the fun hand.
It can't be all just the moral obligation to save
the species. How
will
Michael Tracy not shave his chin during the climate crisis?
Also, don't forget.
Oh, I'm sorry.
JustCoffee.coop featuring 30% off this month. You don't even need to use the coupon code majority. You can if you want, but it won't work, but that's fine. 30% off. Try the different types of Just Coffee. Never had the MR blend? Try it. Never had the WTF blend? Skip it. Go check out. There's so many other blends
so
of coffee.
Petty.
You might as well.
So goddamn petty.
Even in,
you know,
in the face
people
of
take
the dude's going to be in the next Batman movie. He doesn't need that coffee
Joker
stuff.
Movie, but fair enough. Some people take in information like we just took in and expands their range of like empathy and input. You're just sort of like
for everybody.
You know what?
For everybody except for Marin.
Don't buy
for everybody
Marin's
except
coffee.
Marin. Found out. I know who wrote that movie. The dude's from Worcester. Guy who wrote the movie.
The Joker movie?
Yeah. Good for him. Anyways.
Worcester's really spreading its tentacles.
Oh, my God. Pawsocks.
Yeah, 2018 was the year of the Bronx. And 2019
is
the year of
Worcester.
Michael, today is Monday.
Yes, indeed.
You're going to have a busy day tomorrow.
Very busy day tomorrow. And I should also say that because next week... We're doing a Sunday show on the 14th with Adoma Kechiachu. But tomorrow, on Tuesday, Soumya Shankar is going to join us. She's an Indian journalist, and we're talking about India's elections. Will Prime Minister Modi get another term and basically sort of end and or cancel the Indian constitution? Or will the Congress Party retake power? We're going to get to that. And then Felix Biederman returns. He's in studio. We're talking about the QAnon hit on the head of the Gambino family, Benjamin Netanyahu's fail son, and various other things that will be amusing. Patreon.com/TMBS, Patreon.com/TMBS, and Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Well over our first 38,000 subscribers. Thanks.
Jamie?
This week on the Antifada... I'm so excited. We had on Brett and Brian from Street Fight Radio.
Nice.
It's been a long time coming. Those guys are awesome. And it's available now, early, 2 days early, for our patrons and free for everyone on Wednesday. So if you've been waiting to sign up, now would probably be a good time. We also recorded a bonus with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session about the movie Us. So that's pretty cool too. Sean's here. You want to say anything, babe? No? Okay. You think I did a good job? Thank you. Yeah. So check it out, folks. It's a really exciting week.
Matt? Congress, but you've heard it before. Records all over the place, and that will continue.
Yeah, the new Literary Hangover episode has broken weekend download records. We've crossed 2,000 listens for the Oscar Wilde, The Soul of Man Under Socialism. So breaking records all over the place. And so check that out. It's on...
Mom!
I couldn't find my wow. Mom! So I just decided to go with it.
Interesting one.
Do that to me!
Wow, how did you and David get to that place in the discussion?
Well, actually, we talk about Oscar Wilde's mom, who during the Great Irish Famine was a fairly revolutionary poet with some pretty... Yeah.
That's awesome. And Oscar Wilde was great.
Oscar Wilde
wasn't just...
Cool.
He was a great wit, but also had
another
politics.
Fun thing. Oscar Wilde's full name is Oscar Fingal's O'Flaherty Wilde. And because he was Irish.
Oh, I
so
know that.
Some Brits, some of the hoity-toity Brits would say his full name in the same style as sort of Barack Hussein Obama.
Interesting.
Like, he's an Irishman. Yeah.
That's
the funny thing is that today you'd want to include that.
Oh yeah, and he did include it. Like he gave an impromptu speech in St. Paul, Minnesota on St. Patrick's Day, and it was very nationalist, Irish nationalistic.
It just sounds like frankly a better name.
Than Oscar Wilde?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, 646-257-3920.